there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical dialogue, discussion, debate, healthcare and science in the news, a little bit of everything, all right here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I thought right out of the box, we probably wanted to talk a little bit about concerns for thyroid cancer and radiation and all of the stuff that's been wandering around, at least in my little tiptoe into Facebook and Twitter has uncovered lots of concern around that. And lots of people have just kind of come up and asked me about it. I've heard from a couple of my pharmacist friends about runs on the bank, so to speak, for potassium iodide. And just in case you haven't been aware of what's going on the planet, there is a nuclear plant in trouble in Japan, and there has been minimal releases of radiation into the atmosphere. Actually, I think we should be more concerned about the water. And there was a story just driving in this morning about trace amounts being found in Tokyo, which, of course, anything above background radiation should raise one's eyebrows. Now, for those of us down jet stream, so to speak, from Japan, just a few things. Take a deep breath and relax and don't panic. Let's say that again. Don't panic. Number two, if there is a release of radiation, it's going to include a lot more than radioactive iodine. However, taking large amounts of iodine when you are exposed to radioactive iodine helps prevent it from being absorbed into your body. And that's what the fuss is all about. There seems to be a jump to the idea that radioactive iodine is the only radioactive isotope we have to worry about in the event of a plume. And that's simply not true. So I wanted to ask people not to lose track of the basic sorts of things that may happen after a radiation exposure. And one of those is getting your surface decontaminated. And in the case of fruits and vegetables and things that are growing, we're going to have to get good about washing our food. So that's not a bad idea anyway. I think I've spent enough time on this. The doses for iodine, should you want it, are available on a link to my website. And so I put that up there. I thought it was a voice of calm in the wilderness, so to speak. And we definitely all need to take a deep breath here. The worst case scenario is not going to happen, all right? It's not the same as a nuclear explosion. Even the meltdown is not like a nuclear explosion. Completely different sort of thing. Radiation gets much higher in the atmosphere, and that is really key. Let's go to our first email. This one from Ines in Spain. I always love it when I get people writing me from out of the United States. And Ines writes, "Dear Dr. Dawn, thanks for your amazing program. I'm a Spanish listener, so please forgive my spelling. Usually downloads your podcast. By chance, I came across a podcast with some information about piriformis syndrome. I've been a daily long-distance walker for years until I started with the right piriformis syndrome a couple of years ago. I've never recovered from that completely. I would appreciate your help on it, especially on postural healthy habits when walking, sitting, or standing. As every doctor and chiropractor that I have visited focus either on anti-inflammatory drugs, massage, and stretching, but I guess there might be other daily little things that would help as much as that. The first thing that I wanted to recommend to you, Inez, is think about using a more anti-inflammatory diet, and particularly I want to talk a little bit about magnesium, which has a natural muscle relaxation effect. I'm not sure what they put in the fertilizers in Spain, and I'm not sure how many organic farms there are, but in the United States, our commercially available fertilizers do not replace magnesium in the soil. Magnesium gets depleted, and therefore there isn't as much natural magnesium in our diet as there might have been perhaps 200 or 300 years ago. The normal levels for magnesium, if one looks them up on a lab table, represent the average levels in the population, but they don't necessarily represent optimum levels. And so anyone who has persistent muscle spasms should try loading up on magnesium. And muscle tightness in general, it's a good thing to try. You can usually do better if you buy a magnesium chelate, that is magnesium plus an amino acid. And the best amino acid for that is glycine. So magnesium glycinate absorbs very well into the bloodstream from the intestine, which means less diarrhea, less cramping, and higher doses in the blood can be achieved, which means higher doses in the muscle, which is where we're going with this. We want to increase muscle magnesium levels. Now, you've been taught about massage and stretching, so I won't go overboard on that. One of the things that happens a lot of times with people is that they develop tension patterns in their body. And so doing actual relaxation exercises where you scan your body, it's called a body scan, and you start at either the top of your head or the tips of your toes and tighten that area and then relax it very consciously, very deliberately. And in doing that, you'll come to areas that are already tight and you'll go, oh my goodness, I've been holding tension in this area. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a cognitive neurofeedback loop going on with your piriformis syndrome, and maybe you actually are holding those buttocks and hip rotators clenched, for example, when you drive or when you're taking a phone call that's stressful. So check into that and see if you aren't perhaps caught in a kind of, as I said, neuromuscular feedback loop. I see a lot of that in my acupuncture practice, and it's clearable. So first thing to do is to recognize the possibility that it exists. I hope that's been helpful. I'm going to take another email. This one from Esther in Florida. Esther writes, I'm 39 and I have diabetes, hypothyroidism, and high blood pressure. I'm having difficulty keeping my diabetes and thyroid problems under control. Approximately 2 weeks before I begin my period, I'm overcome with fatigue, so much that it feels like I've been drugged. I've spoken to my doctors about it, but they tell me it's because of my uncontrolled diabetes and thyroid levels. I personally feel it's a separate problem, and I'm wondering what is your take on that? Thank you for your time. Well, Esther, first of all, I don't believe that separate problem is the way to think about it. I guess in science, particularly in biology, we talk about lumpers and splitters. I'm definitely a lumper. It's taking place in the same body. It's not a separate problem. And this is particularly true of the hormone system. A great metaphor for this that is used very commonly in functional medicine circles is the idea that the hormones are an orchestra, and you need your brass section and your violin section and your percussion section, and the whole thing needs a conductor. If one of the sets of instruments gets off, depending on what music you're playing, that may completely distort the sound of the orchestra. So you can think of your insulin system as a pancreas organ. That's one instrument in this orchestra. Then you've got your thyroid, which is another important instrument in the orchestra. You also have adrenal glands, and of course, your ovaries, plus the pituitary, which is trying to conduct, hypothalamus and pituitary, I should say, which are trying to conduct this symphony and make sense of it. So what I think is going on is that the second half of your cycle is when your body starts to produce progesterone. And it sounds to me like you're getting an exaggerated progesterone effect, which fatigue is a symptom. So what would I do about this? I would, first of all, work even harder on diet and control of the diabetes, getting the, even taking insulin if I had to get those blood sugars under control. I would make sure that I had a good, solid 8 to 9 hours of sleep. Every night, sleep is really important for resetting the body clock, and it's like a metronome for this hormonal orchestra. So sleep is critical. High blood pressure is probably a result of this dysregulation and also of factors being released by your body in response to your unhealthy diabetic state. So focusing on controlling the thyroid, looking into maybe some natural thyroid rather than the synthetic, because the natural thyroid contains T3, and it wouldn't surprise me if your body just isn't making T3 out of the synthetic T4 that you're probably taking. So starting with that, starting with the thyroid, starting with the sleep, making sure the blood sugar control is excellent. And then if you're still having issues with the progesterone, then you may need to look into shifting your cycles, maybe a short course of birth control pills to see if you'd shut it down that way, just as a proof of concept for a couple of cycles. And these are all things that you would need to be working with your primary care doctor about. But taking a more proactive approach and saying, I really want to focus on my thyroid control. This radio doctor said something about natural thyroid. Would you prescribe that for me? There are conversion tables all over the internet. Maybe you can get your doctor to take a walk on the wild side and do something just a little bit different. And if you can't, maybe you need to find another doctor. Good luck to you, because I really do think that the solution to your problems is there available to you. We're going to go to Tony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Yes. I don't want to panic you, Dr. Todd, because I guess you must have known that in the local papers we have detected fallout from Japan in Berkeley, in Livermore Rad Labs, and down in San Diego where my grandchildren live.
Sure, but the amounts are just minuscule. I mean, fallout's a power word. We've had a bump, a mild bump in the radiation levels, but it's detectable, but trivial.
Knowing something about the plants, for the first time in human history, plutonium is being let up into the atmosphere, because what the last plant that went up had fuel rods that were half and half, half plutonium and half uranium,
mm-hmm.
which means that, first of all, I should preface this by saying that every single nuclear power plant contains the radiation equivalent to 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs.
Okay, so what is your question?
My question is, if we have plutonium in the fallout, that raises the possibility of the body handling plutonium as iron and sending it to our marrow and our gonads. And that's something that you're not being told, but I think it's just happening right now. And so I'm going to continue with this in an email, because there is something happening that we are not being told about.
All right, very good.
Yeah,
thank you. And we're going to go to Alice with a heel problem. Hello, Alice. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dom.
Good morning.
I want to switch gears here and talk about a heel problem. It's probably Achilles heel or ankle issues, and I was wondering if you have any good ideas on how to rehabilitate this, because I'm a frustrated runner and I'm trying to get back on the road.
Okay. I'm sorry. I kind of missed what the heel problem was.
I have pain when I point my toes. So it's mostly when I point my toes. And I have some tight calf muscles, I know. So those are sort of the things. So when I run, it hurts, and also when I go up hills.
Yes, all right. And it hurts on the back of your heel.
Back of my heel, yeah, and yeah. Way deep in my heel when I point my toe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So like the old song says, the heel bone's connected to the leg bone. In this case, the heel bone is connected to the leg bone. One of the connections is your calf muscles, which braid down to a tendon, the well-known Achilles tendon of Greek mythology, and you have pain right where your Achilles tendon is inserting into the bone called the calcaneus, or the heel bone. The way a bone inserts, or rather, the way a tendon inserts into a bone is rather like the way a tree inserts itself into the earth, which is to say a network of roots kind of spread out and penetrate the bone. You still with me?
Okay.
Now, right where the tendon would tend to rub against the bone, where they're in contact when your foot's pointing and going up, there's always something called a bursa, B-U-R-S-A. And this is a shock absorber pad that the body constructs wherever tendons rub over bones. You have one on your elbow and you have one on your knee. Housemaid's knee is when that bursa in the knee becomes inflamed. A lot of people get olecranon bursitis from resting their elbow or hitting their elbow against something. And the bursa is sort of the fall guy. It's the thing that takes the shock and gets irritated but protects the tendon and the bone, which are mission-critical sorts of tissues to have keep going.
Okay.
All right? Now, if you run, you tend to develop those calf muscles. So stretching is critical. And I think most likely what's going on in your case here is that you're tight in the calf, that's yanking on the insertion of the Achilles tendon, and you either have a bursal inflammation or you're starting to get a tendonitis at the insertion. We worry about Achilles tendonitis in people over 40 because if it's ongoing, it weakens the tendon and people can have actual ruptures. Typically what will be going on is a person will have a little heel pain for a couple of years, maybe a little pain in the tendon itself at the back of the ankle. It's not very serious, so they don't do anything about it. And then they're walking around on a 3-foot embankment and they jump to the ground and the tendon snaps on them. So you don't want to go there because that's a cast for like 4 to 6 months. Not fun. So stretching before and after exercise, first thing in the morning, before you get out of bed, wrap a rubber thing or a bathrobe belt under your foot and pull the tendon up. Exercise by standing with the front part of your foot on a step and letting the weight of your body pull that calf muscle down. That's an excellent exercise, by the way, because the calf muscle is very strong. One calf muscle can lift your whole body weight. You stop and think about it. Does it all the time when you're climbing upstairs and such. So getting that thing stretched really takes your full body weight.
Okay.
All right. You're going to embark upon a program of stretching. Before and after exercise, try to get those calves stretched. And I think you need to do it slowly, because if you do it quickly, you'll be rocking those roots where they go into the bone and you might make matters worse. So it has to be slow, controlled stretching, not overstretching, increasing gradually. But I think if you do that, your heel pain will probably spontaneously resolve.
Okay, so in the meantime, I can walk and bike and just hold off on the running till the pain goes down a little more?
Exactly, and you want to warm up.
Okay.
Also, check the shoes. Sometimes a pair of running shoes will put pressure on an area, but from what you're describing, I don't think it's a shoe issue.
Do you think in general that wearing shoes with a slight heel lift would help a little bit, or that's not really needed?
Well, in the short run, it will help in terms of relieving pain, but in the long run, it'll actually aggravate the problem if you don't do the stretching, because it'll tend to result in shorter heel cords, which is the opposite of what you're after. Another thing I thought I'd throw out, those rocker shoes that are very popular right now because they supposedly burn more calories, I've been seeing them proliferate. I think I even saw them at Costco the other day, and when it's really part of the American zeitgeist, they have it at Costco. So those probably are not a great idea for people who have this issue or have tight calves, because you might run the risk of actually aggravating this condition with those types of shoes. Although,
right.
In the long run, those shoes would probably make it better. So
no,
ironically,
you mean when I'm not in pain.
Yeah. Okay.
With a healthy foot. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. We had an off-air comment from someone who called in saying, yep, those rocker heel shoes definitely gave me an Achilles tendonitis. And I found that the hot jets from a jacuzzi directly on my heel helped a lot. And that makes sense, because heat is also healing and increased blood flow would help get rid of inflammation. And that totally makes sense. So I guess I should have told the other lady that heat on her heel would also have been useful. And indeed, I agree with that. Just didn't think of it. Let's do another email. It's worth answering. I got a question about my not understanding TWINA, one of the 5 essential branches of TCM. And the person wanted to know, what is my background in TCM? And my background in TCM is minimal. My acupuncture background is in French energetics, and I learned most of my acupuncture through something called the Helms Institute for Medical Acupuncture, which is a program designed for doctors. So it piggybacks on people who are coming in with a Western allopathic background, which is philosophically very different from the TCM background. So I hope that answers the caller's or the writer's question. Let's go to Joan in Pacific Grove. Hello, Joan, and welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm 72 years old. I have diabetes, and I've been having a lot of problems with my hands. My hands are very sore from the time I get up in the morning to really all day. It's difficult to make a fist. I don't have the strength to open jars. If I drop something, it's very difficult to pick it up.
How's the sensation in the tips of your fingers? Is the sensation okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't feel like you're wearing gloves or anything?
No.
Good. Okay. So it sounds like arthritis or inflammation in the joints of your hands. It would certainly give you those symptoms. Have you seen a doctor or had hand x-rays?
No. I've been taking vitamins, and I was wondering if is the glucosamine helping me or hurting me? Is that, has sulfates in it? Does sulfates hurt or help?
Oh, don't worry about sulfates. Your body needs sulfur to get rid of toxins, so your body will put the sulfur to good use. With respect to glucosamine, there is data that it slows the progression of arthritis in the knees. And from that data, we have kind of expanded to using it for all sorts of arthritis with mixed results. Some people seem to find it has a pain-relieving quality, and that's always worth getting. When people do get pain relief from it, I'm very happy and encourage them to stay on it. If you have knee arthritis, I encourage you to use it whether you have pain or not. And in hand arthritis, I don't see any way that it could be hurting you. Let me start with that. The glucosamine and the sulfate are harmless compounds. Your body may not be able to use them to lubricate the joints, but that is the cognitive model, the explanation for why people think it may work. So I'd say won't hurt, might help, but isn't enough.
What about the magnesium that you mentioned earlier? Would that help me?
Let me start with emphasizing good diabetic control and getting your high sensitivity C-reactive protein checked to make sure that you're not carrying a lot of inflammation, because insulin is an inflammatory hormone and it can raise your levels of arachidonic acid, which increases your prostaglandin, and you can think of prostaglandin as the pain signal for your body, so you don't want more pain signal. The swelling and the stiffness of the arthritis that you describe are often related to inflammation and not necessarily to the actual joint wear and tear, and therefore can be altered. So if there was one thing vitamin-wise that I would say would have the highest probability of helping you, it would be high-dose fish oil. And when I say high-dose, I'm talking about maybe 4,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids, so a lot. Now
I take 1,000 now, but not
4,000. And that's a big dose. If you're on blood thinners, that might be too much. You might end up getting sort of a double whammy and having your blood be too thin. On the other hand, if you can reduce your dose of blood thinners, I don't see it as a bad thing. With respect to that dose, the anti-inflammatory effects come along with the blood thinning effect. And so we take it as high as we can without making your gums bleed, basically.
That 4,000 dose, that's not dangerous, is it?
I just spoke to that. Only risk really is overthinning of the blood, which is going to be a bigger risk for people on blood thinners.
All right. I got yelled at by the doctor once because of that. He said not to take blood thinners because I was getting black and blue marks, and my hands got all black and blue.
Well, I don't know what blood thinners you were taking at that time.
Well, aspirin, the omega-3s, and I don't know if diabetes medicine thins your blood.
No, not most of them. I was thinking more about Coumadin or the new Pradaxa, which is dalbigatran, I think, is the generic name for that. And those drugs are really powerful blood thinners. For you right now, I would say maybe no aspirin and do omega-3s, get them as high as you can without having any bruising, and see what that does for your hands. Other anti-inflammatories that don't thin the blood are turmeric or curcumin. There's a commercial product that contains curcumin as well as a couple of other natural anti-inflammatories that you can buy at the drugstores called Zyflamend, Z-Y-F-L-A, and Mend, like mending your coat. So you could look at that route if you're not able to get a good benefit from the omega-3s.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you and your two friends.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Vigiano. I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. Over there in Corralitos, how do I say your name?
Vigiano.
Vigiano. How can I help you today?
I guess 3 years ago, I finally went to a doctor. I don't go to doctors hardly at all, but she had tested me for AV1, she said that I had atrioventricular stage 1. And
maybe that would be a stage 1 AV block?
Okay, what is that? I know it has to do with the heart.
Right. Do you think that's what she meant? I'm just making sure I'm explaining the right thing. Does that sound familiar?
She didn't say block. She said AV1 stage one. And the only thing I'm noticing is that I get really tired sometimes. And my right hand's starting to get shaky sometimes, but it doesn't feel like it's from the hand. It feels like it's from, like, the core of my body.
Do you have any familial history of tremor? Did your grandparents have a shake?
No, nobody had that. I had rheumatic fever when I was a child. I had a heart murmur and an enlarged heart at that point.
All right. So rheumatic fever is when streptococcus causes the body to develop an immunity, an antibody against the heart valves. And the heart valve gets scarred from the immune attack. And during the initial phases of it, you have a fever and you have joint pain and often there is a particular rash. And this heart valve involvement can cause your heart to leak and certainly will make noise when the blood moves through your heart. So that was your rheumatic fever. It may have left you with some scar tissue on the valve, but it probably has nothing to do with the electrical problem that I believe is the current issue. Let's start with the pacemaker. Everybody's heard of artificial pacemakers, but we all have a natural pacemaker in our heart, and it's located in the right side of the heart, in the upper right, in the right atrium. And this is like a clock ticking, and it sends a little electrical signal out in all directions, but the electrical signal moves across from the upper right of the heart, and as it moves, the muscle contracts. So very quickly, the upper parts of the heart, the right and the left, get, let's call it, infected with this electrical charge, and they contract. And once they've contracted, it's a while before they contract again. That's called the refractory period. And so the upper heart contracts, and then the impulse travels from the upper heart to something called the AV node, atrial ventricular node. And the AV node is like a filter for that signal, and it will let the signal pass, but only maybe 150 times per minute. It won't let the signal pass faster than that. So that's very important for certain heart problems. So think of it as a rate filter. And if the upper pacemaker for some reason is destroyed, the AV node will take over its functions. It'll become a pacemaker, but it's set to run the heartbeat instead of at, let's say, 65 or 70, it's set to run it at 45 or 50. So if a person has an AV node rhythm, their heart is beating slowly. It's still
okay, I have low blood pressure, and it is beating probably slowly.
It could be. Now, an AV block is when the impulse is in the atria, but as it passes through the AV node, it's slowed down, so there's a delay, like a bad machinery that takes a little bit longer to warm up or something like that. All right, so type 1 AV block is where there's just a fixed delay. It's no big deal. The upper heartbeats and the lower heartbeats, and you're still actually making the pacemaker beat at that normal pacemaker. It's just that it's a little slower to pass through the heart. And that can have some consequences for speeding up your heart with exercise, and so that may affect fatigue and blood pressure. And so there could be a component there, but more than likely, it's what we call an incidental finding. So you went into the doctor and you had low blood pressure, so they checked your heart, and they say, oh, you have an AV block, but the AV block may not be the actual cause of the low blood pressure.
Right. I've always had, I think, low blood pressure.
Right. You know, we tend to get worse. Whatever we've got tends to get worse as we age. It's just, the week gets weaker. In this case, everything gets weaker, but the places that were already weak are ahead of the game in terms of getting to thresholds of dysfunction.
I think my blood pressure was like 115 over something.
Not too bad. Okay. So worst case scenario for you, honey, is going to be ending up with a pacemaker. If things keep slowing down, and you go into a type 2 block, which can happen, the type 2 blocks, you actually drop beats. So instead of it just being slowed, you'll actually drop a beat. So you'll be beat, 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 beat.
Ah, okay.
And that one starts to make you at risk for falls and loss of consciousness, and it really can make you tired. So when a person has a type 2 block, we generally send them for a pacemaker. By the way, this is just my opinion. I want to preface this. You know, Medtronic, do not sue me. But in this doctor's opinion, the pacemaker defibrillators are being oversold to patients.
Got it.
And they're more expensive, and you get more money for doing the procedure, and you can talk yourself as a physician into, well, you know, if they have a sudden death event, the defibrillator will automatically, you know, bring them back to life. It's a great thing. The problem, yeah. And that would be absolutely true if the technology was perfect. But since technologies aren't perfect, and when the defibrillator is malfunctioning, it can actually shock your heart inappropriately. I'm sorry, but I've seen way too much software error and computer error in my life to want to install a potentially faulty device that might have a computer error, and the result of that computer error would not be that the device doesn't function, but the device gives me a shock in the heart, tries to defibrillate me. And there are people who have gotten bad pacemaker defibrillators and had to have a second surgery to take them out. So knowing that, why am I giving this person a defibrillator if they don't need one? And how can you justify inserting this device in people who have never had a fibrillation episode just because they might have one someday? It's nuts.
Uh-huh.
All right. I'm off my soapbox.
Is there any diet? I'm on a good diet. I've cut out of certain things.
Well, you need to have low cholesterol. You know, you need to have
working on that.
Lots of fruits and vegetables because they're anti-inflammatory. And most of the time, what causes these big associations for heart disease are inflammation. And probably the reason that statins help people is not because they lower cholesterol, but because they lower inflammation. And that's an unintended side effect, but it happens to be a very beneficial one.
Uh-huh.
So you want to keep the inflammation in your body low, and that's done by eating a diet that's high in healthy fats and fruits and vegetables. And
I've got high in healthy fats. I've cut out all margarine
and trans fats.
All that.
And also watch the things that are fried in vegetable oil.
Yeah, I don't eat any fried things.
Okay.
And I got omega-3s and flaxseed oil.
Well, it sounds like you're right where you need to be.
I hardly go to a doctor, so I'm low income. So basically, if I start really feeling faint, or what would be the symptoms to watch for?
Well, certainly feeling faint when you stand up, if it's persistent. In other words, you know, a couple of seconds, maybe two or three heartbeats of faintness when you stand up doesn't bother me. If you're passing out, it's a problem. If you find that you are having difficulty with increasing the load on your heart, so accelerating, going up a hill, going upstairs.
I'm slowing down because I haven't been exercising.
Right, but the point I'm making is a sudden shift in your exercise capacity would be a big red flag and should prompt a doctor's visit, because that would suggest that you've gone to the next level on this heart block thing.
Okay.
Okay, so sudden change in acceleration, let's call it.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever driven a car that had like a bad fuel filter, or back in the days when there were spark plugs and distributors, you'd lose a cylinder and you would be running on, you know, we still have the expression, you know, just running on one cylinder or something like that. Well, when you go from four cylinders to three cylinders in a car, you really feel the difference, and you feel it with acceleration.
So I would notice that all of a sudden the change is not gradual.
Well, the sudden change is the one that sends you to the doctor, right?
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. That's what you watch for.
And the last question is, instead of a pacemaker, what's the other alternative?
Did I say there was another alternative?
I just wondered if there was.
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh.
Any cardiologists out there who know what else to do for heart block, give me a call. All right.
Is there any operation?
I don't think so.
To repair the valve.
It's not a valve problem. This is an electrical problem.
Electrical. Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I wanted to be sure to tell you about this study that was recently done looking at, well, the usefulness of a training video. And essentially, CPR just changed. It changed because people weren't wanting to do rescue breathing. And so they started doing just chest compressions and found that people were totally willing to get astride someone and push on their heart. And the number of survivals for out-of-hospital arrests went up in a community that began chest compression only. And you can find that story in last year's Ask Dr. Dawn in the archives. But it probably just had to do with the fact that people acted promptly instead of waiting for the ambulance to arrive. Subsequently, a very nice video from the American Heart Association on how to do this chest compression only CPR has been produced. And you will find that on my website, askdrdawn.com, on the resources page. I wanted to tell you that in a study looking at 300 adults without CPR training, and they basically put them in a see the video, get some training, and see the video, no video, and then tested them to see, you know, what was their technique like. And basically what they found was that, at least in this not very real life setting, there was a 25% improvement if you saw the video. Now, that's no big surprise, and I think worth looking at. So go watch that American Heart Association video, and you can link to it from Ask Dr. Don. Something really cool just happened at the Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University. They regrew urethras for five young boys, ages 10 to 14. These were boys who had had damage to their urethras from either trauma or birth defects. The researchers took cells from the inside of the bladder of the individuals, and just a little bladder biopsy, easy to do, not terribly uncomfortable. They isolated the smooth muscle cells and the skin cells and grew them in separate vats until they had enough. Meanwhile, they made a biodegradable scaffolding, sort of in the shape of a tube, of biodegradable material, and then they seeded the inside of this tube with the epithelial cells, the urothelial cells they would be called, and the outside of the tube with the muscle cells. And given the shape, the cells, and these, remember, these are not stem cells, these are just actual cells from the bladder. Given the shape of the scaffolding, the cell said, oh, I'm a muscle cell. I'm supposed to grow around in a circle on the outside of these things. And it did. Just went and grew and formed functional muscular cells and functional muscular tissue. Ditto for the endothelial cells. They also said, oh, I'm a urothelium cell. I'm supposed to grow on the inside of this tube. And they did. And after these tubes formed, they were transplanted back into the individuals and replaced the defective segment where the scar tissue was. The cells took the engineered urethra at 3 months, were biopsied, and were found in all respects to look like normal urethral cells. So tissue implanted, and I think just a fascinating lesson that with all the stem cell work and the other things that we're talking about with reengineering medicine and regenerative medicine, you still need that basic scaffolding. You still need a place to grow, and the structure of the scaffolding itself often contains the missing information that those cells need to do what they're supposed to do, what they're programmed to do. Let's go to Helen in Scotts Valley. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. I'm calling about my husband, who will be 80 in just a couple of days. Very healthy, always very healthy, had a good, healthy lifestyle, no, didn't drink tea, very low wine, never smoked, never had any health problems, except when, 2005, he went to the VA to just start on his health care. They said, of course, he had enlarged prostate. That's what had taken him. He was getting up and down during the night. And they also said his cholesterol was too high. It was over 200 or so at that time. So they started him on Simvastatin, and he was taking 20 milligrams of it. Mm-hmm. In about 07, I tried him taking off and trying natural things like ice and so on. But it started to go back up and started to go over 200 again. So he's been on Simvastatin all this time now to 211, and he's taking that 20 milligrams. What I'm noticing is very warm person. His hands are always warm, even in the coldest temperature. His hands, his, are cold, not that they're getting blue like...
Helen, your connection is dropping out. We're losing, starting to lose about every other word.
Okay. I'm circulation, not, I think.
Yeah, you're concerned about his circulation, right. Okay, so I think the drug is probably Simvastatin, which is Simvastatin, and that's a commonly used VA drug. It's a lucky one who escapes being placed on a statin, because we're just statin crazy in this country right now.
Particularly since his has been below 200. In fact, he's at 173 and better than that.
Stopping a drug, but you have to understand that some of that, the goodness of that number is derived from the fact that he is taking the drug. So what his cholesterol should be and what his doctor is prepared to let his cholesterol be are two different stories. I'm going to not dive too deeply into the statins, yes or no, because I don't have the statistics on your husband to really make a recommendation. But in general, if a person's LDL is below 130 and they're not diabetic, they absolutely do not need a statin, except under very, very special circumstances. And all possible efforts should be made to lower cholesterol with lifestyle, diet, oat bran, fish oil, and all of the other things that we've talked about ad nauseum on this show already. That is key. Then, if you can't get results and the person has a 10% or greater risk of a heart attack in the next 10 years based on good risk factor data, then at that point you maybe think about using a small dose of a statin. That would be the appropriate way for us to manage it.
LDL is 95.
Mm-hmm. And the point I'm making is that we're over-treating as a culture. I think that there's so little that we feel we can control as doctors. And being given this nice mandate to get the LDL below 100 in everybody, it's something that doctors have become very invested in. I'm not sure the data is there for the long-term benefit of doing that, particularly since there are some side effects of statins, and I am concerned about the CoQ10 issue, and again, I'm not going to cover that today. With respect to the change in your husband's circulation pattern, I view that as rather alarming, and it could be a drug side effect. That would be the first thing I would think about. When a person who has always had good peripheral circulation suddenly has poor peripheral circulation, I, particularly in the feet, would look at the possibility that they've developed a blockage or a change in the big blood vessels that go to the legs, perhaps plaque there. And that's something that can be evaluated and should be evaluated at the VA or by his regular physician. There's some simple tests that can look at the circulation. But something's changed and not in a good way, so it needs to be looked at.
Okay, that's my thought too, and I didn't know if I was just being overly cautious.
No, I think it's an important shift and should be checked.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Take an email now. This one from Shaul in Israel. Shaul's written a number of times, and I'm always happy with his questions. He is a 64-year-old male vegetarian with a BMI of 19.5. He always likes to tell me about his good BMI. And he has one health problem, osteoporosis. Recently made my annual year check, and everything is okay except the 24-hour urine potassium was 166, which is above the normal range, and carotene in his bloodstream was 417, while the range is 50 to 200 normally. His vitamin A level was all right, and he eats 1.5 kilograms, yes, you heard that right, kilograms of vegetables a day. This man is an herbivore, and he's wondering, should he eat less vegetables because of this high carotene level? And I want to say resounding no, Shaul, you don't need to reduce your vegetables. There's no toxic level of beta carotene, period, amen. It's a safe storage form for vitamin A, and the body breaks it down when it needs to. So you can have as much of that as you can squeeze into your body and not hurt yourself. In fact, there was a time when you could buy massive amounts of beta carotene in pills, and you'd turn bright kind of carroty orange, and people used it as an artificial tanning pill, but it wasn't a pretty enough color for it to really catch on, but it's quite safe at high doses. I want to emphasize something about normals. Normals come from the word norm, which is the same as average. When I tell people that their results are normal, they feel relieved. When I tell people that their results are average, they feel slightly insulted because, of course, everyone wants to be above average. Well, not in this case. But the norm reflects the average diet of the population. So a person who eats 1.5 kilograms, that's over 3 pounds of vegetables, folks. A person who eats that much vegetable matter a day is not normal in terms of his diet, and therefore you wouldn't expect his blood results to be normal in terms of their numbers. So, Shaul, you're doing great. Don't sweat the carotene. And just parenthetically, I'm intrigued that the annual checkup in Israel includes urine potassium and carotene. And for those of my listeners who are outside of the United States, please educate me about what your yearly checkup with your doctor, what your wellness visit consists of, particularly in countries where they have a centralized healthcare system, or at least a centralized healthcare financing system, which means that those things that have been shown to save money are going to be greatly encouraged. We do not have that here. So I'm very intrigued. What are the things that in a Darwinian situation where the selective pressure is not profit, but survival and wellness, when that's the selective pressure, what are the things that go in a wellness visit? So those of you who have had physicals outside of the United States or whatever they do yearly to check you out, drop me an email or call me and let me know what are the standard things that get done every year, and particularly what are the blood tests, because we don't check 24-hour urines in people and we definitely don't check beta-carotene levels. So while we're talking about wellness, I'm getting ready to make a trip in a few days, and so I picked this about the airport security scanners, and this was a topic a few months ago. This is the first time I've seen data about the actual dosing. The average person in the United States receives a dose of 3 millisieverts or 3,000 microsieverts per year from naturally occurring radiation. So if you do the math, we get about 30 microsieverts a day from naturally occurring radiation. And the backscanner x-ray systems, if the settings are proper and you only go through them once, give you a dose of 0.1 microsieverts, which would be taking you from 30 microsieverts to 30.1. And that doesn't seem like enough of an incremental dose to really create a significant risk. I'm pretty convinced that my body is capable of dealing with way over 30 microsieverts per day in radiation. In other words, detoxifying and damping down the free radicals and repairing the DNA breaks. I'm pretty sure my body can handle, maybe 10 times that much, but certainly twice that much. So going up by a small under 1% increment for the day's radiation doesn't bother me. And I am now saying that I am really not worried about those machines anymore. So I'm happy to be able to share with you my relief, because I was a little bit concerned, but the absolute raw numbers just don't sound that bad. Now, I do think that for people who are going through a machine that isn't adjusted properly or go through it multiple times, there could conceivably be a risk. And I'm really hoping that the Transportation Security Agency actually has a maintenance schedule for these devices and gets in there and checks their output. And I'd love to know, in fact, if that's mandated in the Homeland Security. Maybe we should call it Homeland Insecurity. What do you think? Another little brief news tip that I thought was pretty useful, more about epigenetics, but this one looking at diabetes. And researchers at the University of Cambridge were studying what is the gene linked to diabetes 2 that is affected by the mother's diet. We know that women who have starvation during pregnancy will give birth to children that have a much higher risk for diabetes. And starvation, by the way, we don't necessarily mean just calories, we mean protein. So a person who has a very low protein diet during pregnancy also apparently will have a child with an increased risk of diabetes. So this, I think, is an extremely important news for those of us who are vegetarians, or particularly vegans if you're pregnant. It's going to be a challenge to get enough high-quality protein, but it's a challenge that you need to take, and the use of supplementation is probably highly advisable. The name of this gene, by the way, in case you want to go and search Google Scholar or something for the reference, is HNF4A. And this gene affects the functioning of the pancreas. The research was done in rats, but it is the same gene that is in humans, and it is very likely completely generalizable to the human experience. So eating a balanced, healthy diet during pregnancy, a no-brainer, right? But another reason why it's so important to be sure that the maternal infant food programs aren't cut in this frenzy of budget cutting for social support that's going on. And while I'm on that one, let's write letters in support of funding for National Public Radio, please. I think that is just a blatant attack on the enemies of Fox News. The enemies of Fox News are being attacked by the United States legislature. I think we need to fight back and be one of the enemies of Fox News. One last quick news brief before we finish the show, and that is, actually, no, I'm going to put that down, and I'm going to take a moment, and I want you to join me in wishing two very important people here at KUSP a happy, happy birthday. One of those people is my own Charles Mansky. Charlie is the producer and editor of the show. He's the webmaster. He keeps the whole thing going. And happy birthday, Charlie. And also celebrating is our own Lyle Troxell of GeekSpeak. So happy birthday, guys. And I hope everyone will join me in sending them a little positive vibration. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. And I'll be back next week. Actually, I won't. I'll be off at a conference and we'll be bringing you an archive program. But I'll be learning all about infections and information on emerging infections. So I hope you'll join me for that. When I come back, I'll have lots of good info.